you, Linda, and thank you to the section for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'd like to acknowledge the co-authors. As you can see, they're from many organizations. This presentation is based on a paper that's a work in progress, and so I'm only going to give you a little snapshot of what we've been working on. This started a few years ago when Robin Room was at a meeting with a couple of us in Helsinki, and we started talking about this topic, and then I suggested that we present some of the findings, or some of the preliminary findings, if you will, at APHA. This should be doing something. Ah, there we go. Nothing to disclose. So in the next few minutes, I'm going to try to give you a quick snapshot of these themes, and it's going to be fairly quick, and if people want to find out more, they can leave their business cards with me, and I can send the information along as we move forward on this initiative. As you can see here, there's been a shift, you know, at the global level with regard to looking at diseases. And, you know, for many years, there was a lot of emphasis on infectious diseases, but in recent years, there's been more emphasis, if you will, on non-communicable diseases, chronic diseases. And also, there have been several risk factors, as indicated in the last bullet point, that have seemed to be very central to this. Now, I label these proximal risk factors because, as I'm sure all of you know, there are distal risk factors, you know, behind these factors, if you will, that contribute to chronic disease, such as social determinants of health, environmental conditions, and so on and so forth. But I'm going to be focusing on these more proximal or risk factors. The estimates of the burden of disease and disability indicates that the impact of these chronic diseases is actually much greater in high-income countries than it is in lower middle-income countries. And it's really dependent on five disease groups as listed here. And so the burden is considered to be 80% from these diseases in high-income countries and 72% in low-income countries. Now this slide is a bit detailed. I apologize for that. But this slide indicates, according to the Global Burden of Disease Initiative by World Health Organization, what is the impact on the burden of disease from several risk factors. And you can see the tobacco, alcohol, and various other things such as diet and whatnot, and child underweight and so on, is fairly high up there in terms of the contribution to burden of disease. Drug use is way down there. So you can see this is at the global level. So there's quite a contrast between which factors are estimated to consider to the global burden of disease. So our study, we looked at many studies, many publications since 2000 that examined one of the four risk factors listed here, and we were going to present some core findings of the work on this theme between 2002 and 2013. Several risk factors are relevant, several interventions, pardon me, are relevant to several risk factors, and you can see them listed here. Now, they wouldn't apply, for example, to, let's say, physical inactivity in the same way, but I would say pricing would apply to all four. You could say physical availability probably has some implications. Type of retailing system is definitely relevant to tobacco and alcohol, and controls and marketing promotion, I think, would be relevant to all four. So there's really some common elements just to sort of reinforce what Linda said a few minutes ago. There's lots of evidence, extensive evidence. I don't need to tell this audience how strong the evidence is with regard to tobacco pricing and alcohol pricing. But it I would say it's very underdeveloped with regard to food. I think that there could be a lot more progress with regard to using pricing incentives or disincentives to control the consumption of unhealthy food or even to promote physical activity. And so this is one area where I think the learnings from alcohol and from tobacco probably have some clear implications. And with regard to tobacco, I think the policies in outlet density have not progressed as dramatically as they might have. There have been some initial work on this area, but where I come from, there are still many more places where I can buy tobacco than where I can buy alcohol, for example. So I think that there can be great progress on that. And there is not really extensive progress with regard to controlling density of places where you can buy unhealthy food. I don't know of any place, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong in the discussion, I don't know of any place that says, well, you can have only so many fast food outlets, and at that's the ceiling. But there clearly are restrictions in control states and other places on the number of outlets that sell alcohol. So I think there's some clear lessons to be learned from that area. Now, with regard to marketing and advertising, there have been very great gains in tobacco control. And I think that's a very exemplary area. Alcohol marketing has gone the opposite direction. Despite the best efforts of the public health community, I think that the marketing of alcohol probably is more extensive today than it was 10 years ago. And there have been only modest gains with regard to marketing of unhealthy food. Other interventions, prohibitions of selling to minors, brief interventions, both of them are very relevant to tobacco and alcohol. The tobacco experience, one of the big, big lessons from the tobacco experience is that when you take into account the damage to others who are not smokers, or from alcohol, the damage to others who are not drinkers or heavy drinkers, this clearly helps mobilize the issue at all. It's important in its own right. And I think this is an area where there could be more work done with regard to other risk factors as well. Now, very briefly, some positive experiences, and I'm going to be going over some of the same area, but I think it's important to highlight these. The increase of alcohol taxes and prices have had an impact on many factors, as listed here. And there's an extensive literature on the alcohol field. However, this dimension could be used more effectively with regard to unhealthy food and to promote physical activity. Government-run retail stores, I know they're being eroded. They're being eroded in Canada. I think they're being eroded in U.S. with Washington State and so on and so forth. But they were designed with a public order and public health perspective in mind. And I think it's something to be considered as a tool to strengthen this tool with regard to alcohol, and also consider it as a possible tool with regard to tobacco sales. I've already mentioned the density of outlets. There could be much more work on that in the other areas, because the evidence with regard to alcohol is very strong. I would say of the two measures that have had the greatest impact at the population level, the pricing of alcohol and density are probably the two. And I think that there's lots to be gained from that experience for elsewhere. Now, people may think, well, why am I putting this drinking and driving slide up here? Because how does that relate to food? How does that relate to physical inactivity and so on and so forth? The lesson from drinking and driving is that it's probably the most dramatic change in the alcohol field in the last 30 or 40 years. I challenge you to point to another harm from alcohol that has declined as dramatically as drinking and driving has over the last half century. And I think it's come about because there were a few interventions, they were evidence-based, and they were promoted and widely supported. And I think that's the important lesson, I think, with regard to any risk factor that the public health community wishes to tackle. Now, there are also some negative experiences. This will not come to any surprise to people working in the tobacco field. The alcohol producers are not necessarily very keen on promoting public health by using the most effective measures. As you can see, they typically oppose controls on density, they typically oppose higher taxes, and they oppose controls on marketing or advertising. Three important population level interventions. There's also evidence that even small erosion of controls is risky for health. And I think that's something to be taken into account. And as Linda said, the local jurisdiction has often their power with regard to controlling issues has been eroded. Another negative lesson is that in the alcohol field, and to some extent the tobacco field too, but I think there has been a lot of emphasis on education information as the magic bullet. It's a supplementary tool, it's not an essential tool, and it's not essential to have impact on reducing harm. Another negative experience is that the public health community has not had a consistent voice. They've been speaking with a forked tongue, if you will, from time to time. So you have cancer charities that promote alcohol in order to raise money to prevent cancer. Well, alcohol is a carcinogen. There's a contradiction there. So I think there needs to be much more consistency with regard to the messages. And my last point on this is that there is not a good match between the evidence of harm and the public resources devoted to it. And I go back to the bar graph I showed a while back, and you can see where the different risk factors fell out. This is from some estimates that Robin Room provided for this talk, and you can see that. So there's a tremendous range in the resources devoted to particular risk factors, if you will. So the estimate here from Robin Room indicates that if you look at the bars to the right, looks like about 6 full-time equivalent in 3 World Health Organization's offices working on alcohol. So you have 3 people. This is an estimate, 3 in Geneva, not even 2 in Copenhagen, and possibly 1 in Washington. So looking at this graph, one would get the impression is that alcohol is not a serious problem. At an international level, 3 people in this organization, in this international organization are devoted to that topic. So to summarize, am I okay on time? Focus on the most potent interventions with the widest scope of impact. Not everything can be done. They're not unlimited resources, unlimited time, and so on and so forth. You need a combination of policies. You need to make harm reduction choice the easy choice. So that's why pricing and incentives and disincentives are so important, because it makes it easy for somebody to say, well, I'm going to choose healthy food because it's healthy for me and it's also cheaper than the unhealthy food. Information and education are supportive but not essential, and we need to close the gap between the evidence of harm and the resources to earmark to promote health. So these are some lessons that our group drew from the alcohol experience, and I think there's lots that can be learned, as Linda indicated a few minutes ago, by looking across these risk factors. And here's how you can contact me. Thank you very much.